Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. It is just past 7:33 in the morning. The show is up front. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19. Our guest, Dr. John Swartzberg, clinical professor emeritus of infectious diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
I wanted to start with some very basic questions because I've mostly been camping in places without signal for the past few weeks. One thing that was blaringly obvious in front of me is that the nation is in the grips of a heat wave. And it occurred to me, we kind of know that there is a season when cold weather helps influenza and diseases like it spread. What do we know about the impacts of hot weather on influenza-like illnesses?
Well, starting with COVID, we have not yet seen a weather pattern with COVID. As we're experiencing right now, we're in a swell of cases, a pretty large one. And we saw that this is in late spring and summer. So we don't really have a seasonality yet with COVID. And I say yet because I'm cautiously optimistic that ultimately the relationship of this virus to us will evolve to a seasonality. We have seasonality with influenza, of course, with the season beginning typically right around Thanksgiving, but really reaching its zenith in the early part of January here at our latitude. And then by the end of April or by the middle of April, it's pretty much gone. Still see sporadic cases. So that's a classical seasonal virus. So from the perspective of influenza-like illnesses, we have COVID, not yet seasonal, can occur anytime during the year. We have influenza, respiratory syncytial virus, very similar to influenza, as classical winter viruses. So that's how we look at these viruses in relationship to the seasons right now.
You mentioned the surge in cases. I have been struck by how all over the place the charts of levels of COVID in sewage are. In my corner of the East Bay, it actually looks like something that's been trending down for a couple of weeks. Are the sewer readings losing value as a predictor of how likely you are to encounter COVID in the wild? I was like musing about this and thinking, well, it tells you how much virus is in the sewage, but it doesn't tell you how many people it's coming from. Like, if over time, as people acquire more immunity, maybe more cases does not mean as much COVID, coming out in people's poop.
Right. This is a new tool, whether it's for COVID or influenza or other viruses or other bacteria. It's a very new tool. And we know most of our knowledge comes from looking at COVID over the last 3 years. Like any new tool, we're still learning how to use it. I think your observation is really very important. And that is, there is a rough correlation between the presence of this virus in sewage and how many cases we're seeing. But it's awfully rough. Where I've been using it really is, let's just take now for an example, the surge we had in May and the bigger surge we're having right now in June and July. We've seen, generally speaking, not particular sewer sheds, but when you put them together like the Bay Area, generally speaking, we've seen an awful lot of virus in the wastewater. And we're seeing an awful lot of cases. So there is a rough correlation there. And so it's helpful when you see an awful lot to say, you know, things may be going south for us. On the other hand, the observation you just made, when you look at a particular wastewater area you may not see a correlation at all. So, Brian, I just look at it as a tool that we're still learning how to use.
Are there time spans over which it's more likely? I realize the heuristic I've been kind of going by is over a relatively short span of time, it's useful to know whether levels are trending up or trending down. But you don't use those charts to compare how much COVID is out there now to how much was out there 2.5 years ago during the Omicron wave.
Right. That's a terribly important point. The number of sites that we're testing now is much greater than the sites we were testing a year and a half ago. How we're testing, how the samples are being collected is different. So it's really not a good comparison to look back and say, wow, look at the amount we have right now. It must mean we're in a much bigger wave than we were in a year and a half ago. I don't think we can do that with this tool at this point. So what we are not at a steady state of using this tool, and so we're not at a steady state of being able to interpret it in terms of comparing a temporal association today versus a year ago or a year and a half or 2 years ago.
All right. At this point, let me give out the phone number, invite our listeners to ask you their questions about COVID. The number is 1-800-958-9008. That is 1-800-958-9008 to make a corona call to Dr. John Swartzberg. And while they are hopping on the phones, I have some questions that have been burning up in the inbox. The first comes from Sarah in Richmond. I'm going to paraphrase because it's lengthy and refers to some other people, but she is asking if we continue to see a kind of meager public health response to COVID with declining rates of booster use, if we are in a situation where after multiple rounds of infections, most of the population will wind up with some form of long COVID eventually.
I don't think so. In terms of most of the population ultimately winding up with long COVID, like with wastewater, Brian, we're still trying to understand long COVID in terms of who gets it, how many people get it, why they get it. We've made a lot of progress in the last year, but it still feels pretty random in terms of who gets it. We have certain things that are fairly well established now. If you've had a really bad case, for example, hospitalized or had to go to the ER, you're more likely to get it. If you're older, you're more likely to get it. If you're female, you're more likely to get at least some manifestations of long COVID. And the list just goes on. But right now we're seeing a fairly stable number of roughly, and I'm saying roughly, around 7% of people who get acute COVID wind up with long COVID. The vast majority of those people fortunately get well, but it may take many, many, many months. But some people, as everybody knows, aren't getting well from this, and that's just tragic. But I think that we can say with confidence that the large majority of people who get infected with this virus do not get long COVID. It's just that we don't know in terms of the individual whether that person's going to get it or not. And that's why I think we all have to have trepidation about it. And having had COVID before, I've heard so many friends and people say to me, well, I had COVID before and I didn't get long COVID, so I don't have to worry about it. That's unfortunately just not the case. You could get it the second time you've had COVID or the third time you've had COVID. So again, we don't have as much data, we don't have as much knowledge about long COVID as we need to really make broad statements. So to answer Sarah's question more in a more pithy fashion, no, I don't think everybody's going to get long COVID. I think it's going to be a certain relatively small percentage of people, but that relatively small percentage of people multiplied by the population of people who have COVID means millions of people will have long COVID.
Mm. But also an important point that long COVID is not necessarily a permanent condition for people who get it, just longer That's than right. the acute phase of the illness.
That's right. As I said, the vast majority of people who get long COVID do get well.
On that note, I was trying to go through the things that got published while I was camping in areas without any access to the internet. It seems like there's been a decent number of new papers confirming one mechanism for long COVID is probably autoimmunity, that the body's response to infection produces antibodies that move on to attack the body. There are a bunch of animal studies kind of collecting antibodies from people who'd had COVID and injecting them into mice and seeing what the antibodies did in the mice's bodies, things like that. How is it useful? Does it tell us any, or does it imply anything about the likelihood of the broader population getting long COVID after repeated exposures?
It's tempting to make that jump in thinking, but at this point, we just don't know. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that information about long COVID has been some of the most interesting science that has come out recently in terms of what causes long COVID in a substantial number, what may cause long COVID in a substantial number of people. So these particular antibodies that we produce triggering it in mice, it's really terribly suggestive that there's some relationship here. So this is a very fruitful line of inquiry. But I don't think we can jump from there to say that repeated infections mean you may have more antibodies, certain antibodies that could trigger long COVID. We just don't know that at this point. But the autoimmune hypothesis has been around for a long time. I think it's unlikely that it's going to account for all the cases of COVID, but it could account for a substantial number of them.
And helps explain the distribution of long COVID disease burden, right? Autoimmune diseases are more prevalent in women and people with 2X chromosomes. They have stronger immune systems. The downside of that is that they have higher levels of autoimmune disease. That would explain why reported long COVID rates are higher there.
That's right. That whole field of the relationship of your genetics in terms of 2X chromosomes versus one, and the dance that we have with infectious diseases is absolutely fascinating. Generally speaking, what you said is absolutely correct, and that is, in general, women handle, or people with 2X chromosomes, I'll just say women handle, infectious diseases better than males. That's not always true. Hepatitis, chronic hepatitis, tuberculosis, may not have that same relationship, may have the opposite. So it's not true with every infectious disease, but it's true with most. And that's just absolutely fascinating.
All right. I have more emails. We also have some people waiting patiently on the phone lines at 1-800-958-9008. Let's go back and forth. Ken is on the line in Sunnyvale. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Brian. You have been bringing this doctor for years now, and you know, you guys claim that you're not a corporate media. From my personal experience, the information I've been getting from tens of thousands, endless number of scientists, doctors, which disagree every level with this doctor that you bring, and you don't bring anybody. You know, this many years later, you're still talking about this. There is a debate last week.
Ken, I appreciate the critique, and I appreciate that you keep listening for some reason. We opened the phone lines for questions. Do you have one?
The question is, which people are wondering what the truth is. During the debate, there was no discussion of COVID. So, Attorney General of Kansas, State of Kansas, criminal lawsuit against Pfizer because of the termination of pregnancy and so many other things. A few days before that, somebody whom I know told me that.
You're losing me when you ask about litigation in another state. Do you have questions about like the infectious disease that the segment's on?
Yes, everything this doctor is saying is opposite. The question is,
right? I'm going to give you one more chance to end a sentence with a question mark before we go on to the next caller.
I know from my own experience, crossing the heart of somebody.
Okay, I know from my own experience is not the start of a question. Sorry, Dr. Swartzberg. Let's go to Susan in El Cerrito next. Good morning, Susan.
Yes, hi. I had a vaccine in November, and it was an RSV vaccine. And I had it, and they injected me in the deltoid region of my arm. And I wasn't able to, my arm kind of blew up, and I wasn't able to move my arm for like months. And now I'm afraid to get a vaccine again.
What's your question, Susan? Should you be afraid?
I'm just wondering, that because the vaccine was not injected properly or something went wrong, that now I'm wondering, I want to get a COVID vaccine, but I'm afraid to do that because of all the problems I had getting vaccinated with the RSV. Yeah. Does the doctor know anything?
Dr. Swartzberg, as I understand it, this is the single most common reported form of vaccine injury, is actually physical injury from the needle hitting the wrong part of the arm. If it's something that you've had once, is it something you should be concerned about happening again?
I think so. At least it's something certainly it can should concern somebody, because what Susan has experienced can be very, very debilitating, to have a very sore shoulder for a long period of time. Fortunately, it's not very common.
It was for months.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry that happened to you.
And I had to go to a body worker and get the movement back.
Well, a couple of things to say, Susan. One is, as you've noted, this was with the RSV vaccine. It can occur with any vaccine. And if it occurs with one particular vaccine, it doesn't mean the next time you get that vaccine, it's going to occur. It may be more of a mechanical phenomenon than what's in the vaccine. In terms of RSV, the good news for you is you won't need it again this coming year. If you had it last November, we know that it's good for over a year, and we think it's probably going to be good for a lot longer than that. So you don't have to worry about getting the RSV vaccine again. In terms of getting the COVID vaccine in the fall, the updated one that will be coming out in probably September, you have to weigh the risks of having that problem again versus the benefits of having the booster. I think that almost all the data that we have suggests that the risks of having a sore shoulder for even a prolonged period of time like you've had aren't necessarily going to. That doesn't mean you're going to get that with this next vaccine. Get it in the other arm this time. But I think if I was weighing the risks of one problem that is a complication of COVID because I'm not vaccinated versus the risk of having a bad shoulder again, which is a significant problem, for me, the scales clearly tilt towards getting the vaccine. And it's unlikely you're going to get that again.
Susan, I wasn't clear from your question. Have you had the original COVID vaccine? Is this just a question about the booster, or is this a question about getting any COVID vaccine at all?
I've had seven COVID vaccines, but having the injection done inadequately has been so devastating for me, because I didn't have use of my left arm completely for about 8 months. And I had to work on this. So I'm afraid of the whole process. But I guess when I do get the vaccine, I'll get it at a doctor's office, and I'll be very careful that they inject it properly. So
right. And so so it's your understanding that your problems were a result of the needle hitting the wrong place?
Yes.
You've had plenty of vaccines.
It was the deltoid region. It was too high, too deep.
I'm so sorry. That sounds really, really difficult. Thank you for calling in with your question. Let's take our next one from Sylvia in Oakland. Good morning, Sylvia.
Hi. Good morning. Yes.
Yeah, you're on the air. What's your question?
Okay, great. Yes. My question is, I'm wondering what the current return to school or return to work criteria are right now after testing positive for COVID. the CDC site.
How long do you have to isolate for?
Exactly. Yeah. Or when they can, because I've heard that, on one hand, I've heard that if you're asymptomatic but still testing positive, you can return to school and return to work. And I wanted to check the doctor's opinion about that.
Right. So, Dr. Swartzberg, I think we should probably discuss both the rules and the best practices, which are not necessarily the same.
Well put, Brian. So, Sylvia, it's an important question. The CDC in the early spring made the decision to treat COVID very much like we treat influenza and other respiratory infections. So for somebody with a respiratory tract infection, let's say with COVID, you would stay isolated for at least until there's been at least 24 hours where your symptoms have been improving and you have not had fever and it's been 5 days. So you could actually come out of isolation even earlier, but usually it winds up being around 5 days. So that's the criteria. So if I had COVID today and a few days later, I'm really improving and I've not had fever in more than 24 hours, not taking aspirin or Tylenol to reduce the fever, then I could come out of isolation 24 hours after that. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to ask, is masking still necessary after those 5 days?
Yeah, thank you. So after those 5 days, it's recommended by the CDC that you wear a mask for the next 5 days. So it's been then a total of 10 days since you tested positive or became symptomatic. You wear a mask when you're indoors with other people. So, for example, going back to work or going back to school, you should wear a mask for those next 5 days. My discomfort comes from this is that we know that generally speaking, this will work for a large society of people, but for an individual, I'm not sure it's the best advice. What I mean by that is if you fulfill those criteria and you test, let's say on day five or day six, the morning of day six before going back to school or back to work, and you're still testing positive with the home test, it's very likely you're still contagious. And I would recommend staying away from other people, staying isolated until you test negative, which usually occurs around day five, six, or seven. So I think from a general public health standpoint, it's not unreasonable what's recommended. From the individual's perspective, the safest thing I think to do is do that rapid test when you're feeling that you're ready to come out of isolation, you fulfill the CDC's criteria. And if that rapid test is negative, then just wear a mask the next 5 days and you're home free. If it's still positive, stay in isolation a little longer.
Dr. Swartzberg, what about repeating the rapid test just to make sure you didn't get a false negative?
I would repeat it every day if you have access to it. And have the resources to pay for it, which is a whole different topic. It should be for free, but I would repeat it every day.
For how long? Like how long till you're out of the woods on a prospective rebound?
Well, that's difficult to say. Typically rebound is going to occur within a very few days of having COVID. So the typical person will say they're better on day five and they're clearly getting well. They may even be testing negative, and then 2 or 3 days later, they test positive again and their symptoms return, albeit usually milder. So that's the typical picture. But we've seen people rebound a week, 10 days later, even sometimes a little longer than that. So rebound is a risk that we all have, whether or not we've taken Paxlovid, because it occurs in both groups, not taking it and having taken it. So rebound is a risk.
Sorry to keep following up on all these hypotheticals, but they're all directly applicable to people in my life. If you are in the immediate aftermath of an infection, that you recovered from and tested negative from, is it possible to rebound, in other words, to have your viral levels shoot up enough to make you infectious again without actually having symptoms that come back?
It's possible. Typically, what we see is symptoms returning, albeit milder, along with the testing now positive again. But it is possible to virologically be positive and theoretically be contagious. I think that generally speaking, if you have rebound, that is symptoms return and you're testing positive again, you definitely are contagious.
All right. That music means I've been bending your ear for too long. Dr. Swartzberg, thank you so much for spending another Monday morning with us.
You're welcome and welcome back.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. Appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.